You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Evers used his veto powers to increase funding to public schools in the state budget. Now state Republicans are trying to prevent that from happening again. We'll take a look at their latest proposal. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen, who talked to a Wisconsinite about his mission to preserve traditional Indian folk music.
Ankur Malhotra splits his time between Wisconsin and New Delhi, India, where he runs Amaras Records, an independent record label that produces vinyl releases of traditional Indian folk music. He grew up in New Delhi, then earned his MBA at UW-Madison in 2001. I asked Malhotra about the events that pulled him back to India to search for ancient musical masters.
It was a couple of things that were going on at that time. Part of it was I was by this time living in the States and fully immersed in the local community and kind of volunteering both on radio and with the community festivals and so forth. And as I was kind of getting immersed in the space, one of those things that kind of became more evident and more telling was there was no music from India. We are the second largest country in the world, population-wise, country which is rich and steeped in culture and, you know, musical culture specifically. And this was kind of, you know, why isn't it there? And, you know, one day I was chatting with my longtime friend, Ashutosh Sharma, who's co-founder with Amaras Records, and listening to some of these records, we were thinking about, you know, who are the Indian bluesmen? You know, who are the Indian folk stars? And we really couldn't come up with names. And that for us was, well, a matter of shame, but it was also a eureka moment because we knew they were out there. So it became a kind of a, oh, well, what if we go out to find them? And we just got into the car and drove into the desert. There were, I think, 5 villages, 40, 50 musicians we met on that first trip in December 2010. And towards the end of that trip, we're driving back and, you know, there's Laka Khan, this master musician, plays the Sindhi Sarangi, a 26-string Indian folk instrument. And, you know, we show up at his home late in the evening and, you know, he decides to play us a couple of songs. And once you hear the sound of the sarangi and once you hear Laka Khan singing, you know, there's this raw, powerful voice, but there's also this melancholy. He's the 7th generation master musician of this instrument and perhaps the last. And that weighed heavy on him because, you know, his sons didn't pick up the instrument. And that kind of explains some of the deep sadness and melancholy that's so evident in his music. What will I leave behind? We also recorded some other master musicians, some of them no longer with us today. One of them was the late Rukma Bai, one of the very few female singers from this community of musicians, the Manganyars from Rajasthan. She was struck with polio at a young age, so she didn't have her legs. Yet she had been performing all her life. So we were at her village in Barmer, about 40 kilometers from the Pakistan border. And while we're recording her, she shouts out to this man walking down the village street, "Mangya." Bring your harmonium and accompany me on this track. And we're about to pack up when Mangya, this harmonium player, pipes up and says, "I also sing, may I?" And he starts singing. And we both have goosebumps down our arms. That was the voice of Mangya. the voice of Barmer Boys, the band that we know today. But I think 2017, we ended up actually setting up a vinyl cutting lathe in India. And now, you know, we are the only people in India making records.
You split your time between Madison and India, and most of the artists on your label are from India or some from Africa. So what keeps you in Wisconsin?
Madison is a beautiful town. You know, I've been here 20 years, and it's such a fabulous community. You know, I could be living in a big city, and I lived in a big city. I'm a Delhiite. And then we are in the beautiful outdoors and nature and you know, Black Earth Creek. I love fly fishing and things like that. Just, you know, step away and 30 minutes later, you're enjoying beautiful outdoors of the state. It's such a beautiful, welcoming culture and accepting. And that's been one of those things which has kept me here.
You mentioned this pressure that Laka Khan feels to pass along these musical traditions. Do you feel a similar pressure to preserve this music?
Yes, there is this kind of unrelenting pressure, you know, just that these musicians aren't getting any younger. Someone like Laka Khan probably has 400, 500 songs in his songbook, all in his head. Most of it has never been recorded. And there's going to be a point pretty much in the near future where, you know, he's going to stop touring. Is that an end of a livelihood? Is that the end of the music? For Amaras, we feel that there is still more that can be done. So if that transfer doesn't happen or is not made, or, you know, we kind of don't take efforts to capture some of this music, it's going to be lost forever.
Ankur Malhotra is the co-founder of Amaras Records. A longer version of this story can be heard on WPR's Arts and Pop Culture program, Beta. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television, in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, we'll talk about how Wisconsin governors have used their veto powers to tweak the state budget and how a new proposal could change how those powers are used in the future. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up with the passing of Ross Perot this week, we look at the history of third-party presidential candidates and whether there's a place for them in today's politics. First, state Republicans want to change Wisconsin's constitution to put a new limit on the governor's veto power. The plan would prevent a governor from using their veto pen to increase spending. The move comes after Governor Evers signed the two-year state budget last week. He used his partial veto authority to give public schools a $65 million boost. Republicans say Evers abused that power. Evers' office called Republicans sore losers. What do you think? Call in at 800-642-1234. Should Wisconsin governors be allowed to use their veto pen to increase spending? Did Evers go too far in using it to give schools a bump? Would you support a constitutional amendment to keep governors from using this veto power in this specific way? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Mordecai Lee is a professor emeritus of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee and a former state lawmaker. Mordecai, good to have you back.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, I think nobody's suggesting that Governor Evers did anything illegal here, but is there a case to be made that this is not a proper use of the governor's veto power?
You know, legislatures, whether Democratic or Republican, have been trying to clip the wings of governors when it comes to their partial veto power since I was there in the 1980s. And no matter what they do, trying to clip the wings, a governor can find a way for that bird to fly. And I think what happened last week is a perfect example that almost no matter how many rules the legislature can come up with for the constitutional language on partial vetoes, governors can be very creative in finding ways to do it. And Rob, probably the most important thing that we should emphasize is that if your listeners remember that a governor's veto powers, lying out in veto powers, cannot increase a number, they're remembering correctly. A governor can't change, 10 million to 100 million. Governors can only, when we're talking about numerals, reduce numbers. So it might be from 10 million to 1 million, or even Tommy created the precedent where you could write in a digit. So he could change 10 million to 9 million. But what Evers did was much more complicated, and that's that by selectively deleting some words in a sentence, he changed what the legislature was increasing state aids by to a higher number. And I think it would be hard to figure out a way to prevent that. After all, he didn't change a number. He didn't increase an appropriation in a direct sense. So I'm really not sure if there's a legislative drafting way to do that.
And we've got this long history of this powerful line item veto. I was looking at the history books a little. This originally happened because legislatures, instead of doing the education budget here, the transportation budget there, they did this one big bill. And the thought was, okay, that puts a lot on the governor. They have to say yes or no to this whole shebang. We're going to let them sort it out and do bits and pieces here and there. We ended up, right, Mordecai, with a pretty powerful partial veto in the hands of the Wisconsin governor in the scope of other states.
You know, I suppose for a 10-second professor's lecture, if people are remembering correctly that in Congress, on the federal level, that indeed they pass about 13 appropriations bills. They slice and dice the executive branch. And it's in Wisconsin where they don't do that. They just pass one bill. And this year, the legislature tried its best to narrow the partial veto options by sending, first of all, a very short bill, only about 500 pages instead of the more normal 1,000, and by using phrases like cannot instead of may not. Cannot is one word. You can't veto letters in a word. But cannot is different from may not, because may not is two words. I remember when I was in the legislature, we came up with the idea of banning what we called Vanna White line item vetoes. Vanna White being, turning off letters and just creating new words. And we passed that, but even then, governors were still very successful at changing the meaning.
I want to give a listen to former Governor Tommy Thompson. He said this week that state Republicans are on the right side of this issue. Let's give a listen.
I support it because I do not believe, even though I'm the record holder of vetoes,
right.
I'm not going to criticize a governor for vetoes, but there's one area I do not believe governors should be able to veto, and that's increased appropriations. I never did that. I reduced appropriations, and I don't think a governor should have that right.
The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel pointed out that in 1991, Thompson used his partial veto to add $54 million in property tax cuts to the budget, which is a kind of appropriation. Can you talk about Governor Tommy Thompson and his use, often people said creative use, of this partial veto power?
Well, Tommy was very aggressive in using his line item veto power, whether he was dealing with a Democratic legislature or a Republican legislature. And he was the one who created the precedent that he could write in numerals that were not in the text that was presented to him. And it, of course, went to the state Supreme Court. And he made the argument that, to use my example from a few minutes ago, that 9 million was a part of 10 million. And therefore, he could write in the digit 9. And was it constitutional? And the state Supreme Court ruled that it was constitutional, that the language of the Constitution is simply a part of. And so what is a part of? It's anything less than what the number is in the text.
It gets kind of philosophical, doesn't it, Mordecai?
I think so. Generally speaking, the purpose of the line item veto for the last 100 years or so has been so that governors could restrain runaway legislatures. In other words, that legislators love to spend money, theoretically. They all want bridges in their districts. They all want superhighways in their districts. And that the governor was elected statewide, and he would be sort of the adult in the room. It didn't quite turn out that way. There are so many different ways to change a bill, because we're not just talking about numbers. It's important to emphasize that the line item veto power applies to any bill that has any money in it. In other words, we're not just talking about the state budget or an appropriation of money. We might be talking about bonding or caps on something. Anytime there's a number in it, it's subject to line item veto, and that's why it's just such a powerful veto.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Roger with us in Madison. Roger, hi.
Hi. I was around for the Vanna White, the famous Vanna White vetoes, and I don't know that Tommy Thompson has much room to complain. I think it's really a shame that our state government has reduced itself to a gerrymandered majority and a governor who can only get something like what they were hoping for in their budget by applying this sort of a veto. Neither of those things should be necessary, and in fact should be done away with. The essential thing in making government work for us out here is to have a decent amount of tension between the two political parties and whatever other political parties there are that want to pull some strings.
Roger, thanks for the call. Is there a better way to do this, Mordecai? Even under our current system and laws, could we have seen a better system of negotiation in this case between the Democratic governor and Republican lawmakers?
Well, Rob, there's no doubt that, you know, it's just warfare in the state capitol. The Republican legislature essentially claimed that the governor's budget proposal was DOA, dead on arrival. They crafted their own budget with their own preferences. Nobody negotiated. Nobody talked to each other. Nobody compromised, that dirty word that one can barely say anymore in mixed company. And so I think to a certain extent, Governor Evers feels that he sort of paid them back. If you won't talk to me, then I can accomplish things with my line item veto. And you can try all you want to limit my line item veto powers, but governors still have enormous power. For example, even if there were to be language that says that the partial veto can only apply to numerals, in other words, not to words, I think even then it would still be hard to prevent a governor from taking advantage of certain wording and being able to, in de facto sense, increase funding.
Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Roger, Mordecai Lee is with us, Professor Emeritus at UW-Milwaukee, talking about the governor's line item veto powers, efforts by Republican lawmakers to get a constitutional amendment to change that. We'll go back to your calls. Gwen is with us in Madison. Gwen, hi.
Hello. Sorry, I'm losing my voice here. I think that the Constitution should not be amended. We elected Governor Evers, and Wisconsin is severely gerrymandered, and we still managed to elect Governor Evers, and I think that the legislature should grow up and work with our governor for the good of our state instead.
Gwen, thanks for the call. The gerrymandering doesn't affect the election for governor, Mordecai, since that's there's no borders within the state on the vote for governor. But two callers have mentioned how gerrymandering affects control of the legislature itself.
Well, there's no doubt that everything we learned in high school civics is still true, and that's that in the way governments are structured in America, we have separate branches of government that check and balance each other. And so whether a legislature is Democratic or Republican, whether a governor is Democratic or Republican, they see the world differently. There are just sort of inherent sort of tensions between the two bodies. So while you would expect me as a professor to support nonpartisan redistricting, I think that given the situation we have now, what Governor Evers did was try to checkmate a Republican legislature, which has been so hostile to him. And for a while, I really thought he was going to veto the entire budget bill and keep the legislature in session for the whole summer until they finally would talk to him. But he apparently felt satisfied by using this very unusual way to line out and veto K-12 education, that he was able to increase it towards the level that he wanted and that he was really increasing it.
Thanks for the call, Gwen. Time for another caller. Tom is with us in Wauwatosa. Tom, hello.
Hi, thank you. Professor Lee, I actually had you down at UWM. It's good talking with you again, sir. But my comment about this whole situation is I feel like we need to stop with this this polarization between Republicans and Democrats and this tit-for-tat back and forth, trying to create rules to try and stop somebody. I mean, it feels like we're dealing with children, and I just feel like something's being lost about this country, and it's what made this country great was that we had parties that could agree, and when they couldn't agree, they'd come to some sort of compromise, which was reasonable, instead of trying to just put down rules, I feel like we need to get the adults back into the room and start trying to work and make this country what it's always been, which was a country that could work with each other in this country as well as our allies around the world. And I feel like that's being lost in all of this.
Tom, thanks for the call. Mordecai, what do you think?
Well, it's great to know that somebody I knew as a student is still interested in public affairs. Thank you, Tom. Keep up the good work. I think what Tom is putting his finger on is correct. Whether one is a Democrat or a Republican, the question is, do we believe in compromise? Do we believe in moderateness? Do we believe in getting along? And I think we would have ended up with a very different budget if the two sides were willing to compromise. When I was in the legislature, I was in dozens of meetings behind closed doors where we'd be yelling and screaming at each other. Then finally somebody would say, come on, there has to be a number in between where you are and where you are that you can sort of feel like you got half a loaf. And that's true. But we live in a culture, as Tom was describing it, where suddenly half a loaf is no longer a good outcome. Ideologues in both parties view it as betraying their beliefs. And so compromise is out the window and moderateness is out the window.
Thanks for the call. Mordecai, do we need relationship counselors in the next state budget to help bridge these gaps?
Oh, that would be wonderful. I think Governor Evers is trying his best not to be baited by this sort of death struggle that the legislature is used to. After all, it was the outgoing legislature last fall that passed the lame duck legislation limiting his powers. And I'm sure that for some people, what they're seeing in this new initiative to clip his line on veto powers is an extension of that, a kind of we're going to get you, we're in a death match, and we're going to win. I really don't think that's sort of automatically necessary. What Americans don't like is when there's a double standard by politicians. When politicians say, if my party does it, it's fine, but if the other party does it, it's evil. I think that's precisely what we need to get away from.
Mordecai, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thank you.
That's Mordecai Lee, Professor Emeritus of Urban Planning at UW-Milwaukee, former state lawmaker. Talk to them about Republican proposal to have a constitutional amendment to limit the governor's partial veto power. Coming up, a look at third-party presidential candidates in American elections. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show, more and more people are using genetic testing to explore their genealogy. Now those tests are finding their way into the U.S. court system. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the legal fallout from high-tech genealogy. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, according to the New York Times presidential tracker, 24 Democrats and 2 Republicans, including President Trump, are running for president in 2020. Independents, third parties, none so far. Early this year, former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz kicked around the idea of launching a third party or independent campaign, but has since put that on hold. The Times has him in the unlikely to run category. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg also considered getting in. He became a Democrat last year, saying an independent bid would reelect Trump. He decided against running for president in March. Last time a third party or independent candidate really gained any national traction was 1992, when Ross Perot took nearly 19% of the popular vote. Perot passed away this week at the age of 89. We thought it would be a good time to look at the history of independent presidential campaigns and what kind of future they may have, if any. Laura Brown is the director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. She's the author of multiple books, including Jockeying for the American Presidency, The Political Opportunism of Aspirants. Laura, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob, for having me on.
Well, before we talk about third-party runs and independent runs in general, let's look at Ross Perot. Why was he able to capture this significant share of the popular vote? No electoral votes, but a lot of votes.
Well, certainly he tapped into this desire for change. There was something of an exhaustion with the Republican kind of dominance in the presidency. There had been 2 terms of President Reagan and then 1 term of George H.W. Bush. And there was certainly a desire in the country for really politicians in Washington to pay attention to American workers, to pay attention to the budget deficit, and to really take seriously some of the issues that were gaining traction among blue-collar workers who were not feeling served by either the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. And Ross Perot jumped right into that void and announced, essentially on Larry King Live, that he would run if the people got him on the ballots in all the 50 states.
I want to give a listen to Ross Perot. This is from CBS's Face to Nation and Face the Nation in April of 1992.
I believe that there is so much waste around here. And again, every time you get into, see, I'm the only guy that talks numbers. Mm-hmm. I love this. Nobody else will even talk about it. I've said it's like a crazy aunt in the basement. Everybody knows she's there, but nobody talks about her. I'm talking about it.
Now, this was a guy who talked differently than politicians usually talk. Was there something about that, Laura, that you thought appealed to people?
Certainly. And his sense that there were issues and there were numbers and data and facts that the insiders weren't paying attention to, that really the American people needed to focus on government and what it was doing from not just kind of a higher rhetoric standpoint, but from an effectiveness and an efficiency mindset.
Now, this was a wealthy person running against the party establishments of both parties, saying he was talking to a group of people in the public who were neglected by the political class. Sound familiar? Was there a similar strain then to what Donald Trump took advantage of when he ran as a Republican?
Well, certainly this has been a strain of campaigning really since Jimmy Carter launched his bid in 1976. We have seen this desire for outsiders. It originally meant sort of those who were outside Washington and really looked at governors as the primary targets for that messaging. But then eventually that became business people and celebrities and others who were interested in kind of trying to claim the top office.
Talking to Laura Brown from George Washington University, talking about independent and third-party candidates in American presidential races. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we should see more of these campaigns? Have you ever voted for a candidate without a D or R next to their name in the race for president? Call 800-642-1234. Looking back at Perot's first run, 1992, he then ran in the Reform Party in 96. But some people looked at 92 and said Perot took votes away from George H.W. Bush, the Republican incumbent, allowing Bill Clinton to win. Seen a lot of analysis that says, no, that's not necessarily how it panned out. How do you try to break that down?
Well, many political science studies have looked at this, and in fact, most of the most serious kind of analyses of those votes saw that most of what he did was bring new voters into the electorate, people who hadn't really voted for either party, and that he did draw fairly equally from both parties in terms of those people who had already previously voted. So I think what is missing here is that there just was an interest in change in this election, and it was the feeling that neither the Democrats nor the Republicans could deliver on that. Ross Perot seemed an unlikely and interesting candidate, and certainly he was able to capitalize on that restlessness within the electorate.
Now, Ross Perot was the high point when it comes to popular votes in recent history of a non-Democratic or Republican presidential candidate. I did some digging. It looks like the last time an electoral vote went to a third party was 1972. A faithless elector decided to throw their vote to the Libertarian Party. Can you talk, Laura, about the challenges facing someone, even someone with a lot of money to throw into a race, of running as an independent or a third party candidate?
Well, if you want to run as an independent, first you have to qualify for the ballots in the different states. In order to win the presidency, you do need to be on all 50 ballots. And that is a high hurdle and one that requires a tremendous amount of organizing. And that is where, in fact, I think Ross Perot really proved his mettle. The people who supported him got him on every ballot, so much so that eventually became the Reform Party line item, which also was there in 1996 and 2000. But it is also the case, aside from that, that you need to win not just popular votes, but electoral college votes. And that means that you need to place first in states all across the country to try to do that. And this is where the only real kind of successful electoral vote independent candidates have been those individuals who had regional issues, and those were really issues of segregation in the time at mid sort of like 1900. So you saw Strom Thurmond in 1948, and then, of course, George Wallace in 1968.
I've seen people who support third parties say there's an unfair structural built-in advantage now for Democrats and Republicans that effectively locks out anybody else. Is there something to that argument?
Well, the Electoral College itself tends to do that. It is also the case that in our winner-take-all system, where the person who gets the most votes wins essentially the office or all the electoral votes, what you end up having is a situation where voters don't want to waste their vote on a candidate they don't believe will win. And it is also the case that people who are serious contenders don't want to run as an independent because they don't believe they will win. So it ends up being something of kind of a circular problem that is very difficult to get out of because there is something of a lock with the two political parties.
I've seen some math out there suggesting that in a bunch of recent elections, the difference in key states between the votes between the main two candidates, the two-party candidates, you look at that number. And then you look at the number of votes that went to third-party candidates. Even though it wasn't huge overall, the votes for third-party candidates were way more than the gap between the two candidates. So with that in mind, do even these small number of votes for third-party candidates, do they sway the outcomes in key states?
Well, they certainly can. I mean, we can look back just to 2016, and we can look to your state of Wisconsin, and it is true that, you know, Donald Trump won 1.4 million votes there, and Hillary Clinton won about 1.38 million votes there, and Gary Johnson won about 100,000 votes there. So it would have made the difference had those votes apportioned differently for either candidate. The problem is that you can't always replay these elections, and you can't always know who would have voted for whom. I think it is fair to say that a number of Republicans in Wisconsin voted for Gary Johnson because they weren't pleased with Donald Trump as a candidate. But it is also the case that many Democrats voted for Jill Stein, who earned about 31,000 votes there and perhaps could have come close to making the difference for Hillary Clinton. So what you really have is a situation where the people who are voting may matter if the race is close, but in a sort of post-election analysis, it's difficult to truly know how that election would have gone.
Talking to Laura Brown from George Washington University about third-party and independent presidential candidates. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever voted or would you vote for a third-party candidate for president? Or do you see that as a wasted vote? Would you consider a third-party candidate in 2020? Do you think that the deck is stacked against non-Democratic, non-Republican candidates? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about third-party and independent candidates for president after the passing of Ross Perot, who picked up about 19% of the popular vote back in 1992. Laura Brown is our guest, associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think we should have more independent and third-party presidential candidates? Have you voted for one? Would you vote for one? You're looking for one in 2020? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll go to your calls now. Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question for your guest is that what I found troubling, especially with the last election, is that there doesn't seem to be a fiscal conservative, socially liberal third party candidate. In particular, I look at John Delaney for this election cycle as someone who would be a wonderful candidate, yet he is getting zero traction. I also remember John Anderson from what it was 30 years ago when he ran as a liberal Republican. And I'm, as a conservative, I had to vote for Johnson this last election because I just couldn't find myself to vote for the current president. My question is, has the Libertarian Party really co-opted the fiscally conservative, socially liberal aspect, and is there a way to get that type of view out in the voting at possibilities?
Charlie, thanks. Interesting. Laura, what do you think?
Well, you know, I actually think it is fascinating that your caller just brought that up, because that is this ideological space that many of the sort of interested independents want to push forward in. I mean, whether you're talking about Howard Schultz or Michael Bloomberg, some of these individuals are really interested in being kind of more fiscally conservative and socially liberal. And yet neither party seems to care much about it. And if you look at the announcement today that the budget deficit just once again widened to over $700 billion this fiscal year, it's pretty extraordinary how much kind of fiscal restraint or responsibility is not on the agenda of either party. And you would think independents would have a viable space there. But the truth of the matter is there just aren't as many activists in this space as there used to be.
Thanks for the call, Charlie. Harry joins us now from Burlington. Harry, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I find it interesting that you just mentioned what I was going to mention. I've never voted for an independent candidate for the reason you said a few minutes back, that it seems like a wasted vote. But I would vote for any independent who would make the budget deficit the issue, because I think that's the elephant in the room nobody wants to talk about. Both Republicans and Democrats seem willing to spend our grandchildren's future away, and nobody will address it.
Harry, thanks for the call. Laura, I'll put an asterisk on this. I've noted this on the show before. It seems like both parties are really interested in worrying about the deficit when the other party is in control of the White House.
I think that's right. I also think that no one really wants to face kind of the tough medicine that would go with solving issues related to our debt and deficit. I think we have seen attempts at creating commissions and whole proposals and plans, and they seem pretty much dead on arrival. And I would agree with your callers that this is something that should be thought about a lot more than it is. But unfortunately, we're living in a good economy, and so there doesn't appear to be a price that we are paying yet for having this budget deficit that we do.
Thanks for the call, Harry. We heard from Susan on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Susan says, I voted third party, but will not again. I'm a progressive. I'll vote for most Dems. Even if they represent some things I oppose, I will not vote for the extremists, she says, who are Republicans. Now, this was a big topic of conversation, Laura, in the last election. We heard from callers, definitely, who identified as progressive Democrats, who said in that instance they weren't necessarily going to vote for Hillary Clinton. And it seems at least some of them followed up on that. Do you see that as a possibility in 2020?
Well, I do think what is interesting is that because the sort of pundits and the conventional wisdom prior to the 2016 election really suggested that Hillary Clinton was going to win the race, I think there were a non-trivial number of people who said, I'm going to vote for a third party to send a message that I'm not happy with either party's choice of their candidates. And I think many people ended up feeling sort of shocked and surprised when Donald Trump ended up winning, because had they believed he was going to win, they might not have voted third party. So I do think you're going to see really something of what happened in the 2004 election, which is that people said, we don't care that there's a third party candidate. We're not voting for them. We're voting for only the two major parties, because they had felt kind of, you know, bitten and stung by the 2000 election, where Ralph Nader and Pat Buchanan had taken votes in Florida, perhaps to the detriment of Al Gore, perhaps to the detriment of George W. Bush.
Talking about third parties, independent presidential candidates, Laura Brown is with us from George Washington University. Let's go back to your calls now. Jacob is with us in Madison. Jacob, hi.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I'll say that I voted third party in the 2016 presidential election because I was not enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, and so I went libertarian. And I knew that it didn't stand much of a chance of having much of an impact, but I felt like my vote would be making a statement. And I'd be curious about the merits of ranked voting, because I felt like that, or I feel like that might facilitate some independence. And I'm curious about getting into politics myself, and I don't identify as a Republican or a Democrat, and I think ranked voting might enable independents like myself to stand more of a chance.
Jacob, thanks for the call. We hear things like that, ranked voting or proportional representation or other changes to the way we vote, maybe opening the door for third parties. Laura, might be a tough haul to get there, though.
Well, that's right. And I mean, one of the most difficult issues is, let's just say that the Electoral College votes were all allocated proportionally, so that there was essentially more of an incentive for a third party candidate to get in, win some popular votes in a state, and win a proportion of those states' electoral votes. Well, the Constitution does say that if no candidate gets a majority in the Electoral College, then it would go to the U.S. House of Representatives to decide the president. So I think you could end up with some very adverse possibilities were we to go down that road. But, you know, I think there is a valid case for it. I think it is real, given the fact that now sort of the largest plurality in the country actually identify as independents, that there needs to be some way to help independents feel as though they can have representation without selling out their views to one of the major parties.
Is there, thanks for that call, Jacob. Laura, in our last few moments, have the parties changed in a way that they're less of a home to a wider number of people? They're not maybe the big tents with wider ideological diversity that they used to be.
Well, that's exactly right. What we've seen over the last 25 years is that the Republican Party has become more conservative, so it is more aligned with conservative, socially conservative voters, and the Democratic Party has become more aligned with progressive politics, both at the cultural level and at the fiscal level. The Republicans don't really have a clear stance around fiscal policy because Donald Trump pushed them sort of away from their traditional free trade, small government perspective. But it is the case that there is kind of this center of the electorate that a lot of people feel as though they're not being heard, and there might be other opportunities to allow them to vote for third parties were we to change aspects of our system.
Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Laura Brown is an associate professor of political science and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. Her books include Jockeying for the American Presidency. We talked with her about the role of third party and independent presidential candidates after the passing of Ross Perot. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, new rules would loosen up sleeping regulations for truck drivers. A sleep expert tells us about the impact of difficult sleep schedules. And it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We'll get some great inspiration for summertime picnic foods, and you can call in with your favorite ideas. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.